This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. It's time for All Tech Considered and a techie grassroots competition for jobs.
Complimenting people and commenting on baseball. Cincinnati marketing executive Kevin Dugan follows Aguirre on Twitter and sat down to scan all the tweets for a behind-the-scenes look.
Man, I'll tell you what. Let's see. Just today, all those that we just scrolled through, what was that about? I'd say 2 or 3 dozen.
One thing Aguirre does not tweet about much is the possible cost-saving move of his company's Cincinnati headquarters. The fruit and salad company, with annual revenues topping $3 billion, is big business. 330 executives work in Cincinnati, and residents here don't want them to leave. Last month, Dugan and his friend J.B. Krop had an idea. Why not try to talk Aguirre out of the move on Twitter?
I just went to where we knew he liked to play and where he listened and responded. So it was, for us, it was just a natural, made a lot of sense.
They came up with the hashtag NoCincyBananasSplit and are attaching it to every tweet they send out. Michelle Spellman saw the hashtag and is now attaching it to her tweets. As her 8-year-old son, Cannon, eats a banana, she turns the sticker into a teachable Twitter moment.
Cero grasa means zero fat in Spanish. Mm-hmm. So there you go. So let's put that out on Twitter, because I bet you other people saw this sticker and were wondering too, don't you think?
It is possible Chiquita will keep its headquarters in Cincinnati, or it could move to Charlotte or someplace else. In Charlotte, Brian Francis began following Aguirre and launched a competing hashtag, Bananas for Charlotte.
We put a blog up on the Charlotte blog, and we're just overwhelmed by the response. Hundreds of messages from people around the Charlotte Twitter sphere saying the reasons that they love Charlotte and the reasons they think Chiquita would love us as well.
One Charlotte restaurant sponsored a banana pudding taste-off in honor of Bananas for Charlotte. Organizers say there were hundreds of tweets and a response from CEO Aguirre. Consultant for Deloitte, Chris Hewer, works with executives to increase their use of social media. He says it's much like trying to get in behind the velvet ropes at a nightclub. Every day, Twitter users have found a place where they can be heard.
This is something very unique that the CEO would be confident enough to be engaging around this topic and to embrace that playful spirit relative to this friendly rivalry that's developing.
And Hewer expects more CEOs to go this route. He says not everybody has a comfort level for tweeting and being on the record, but Fernando Aguirre does. What does Aguirre think of people talking with him via Twitter? Well, he tweeted me this. Pleasantly surprised, positive for both cities, direct contact with consumers, creative, fun, humbling, and humanizing for CEO. Chiquita will not give the timetable for its decision, so it appears that tweeting will continue in what some are calling the tale of two hashtags. For NPR News, I'm Ann Thompson in Cincinnati.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com.
Another dietary trend that's exploded in recent years is gluten-free products. You can now get everything from cupcakes to brownies to pizza with a gluten-free label. NPR's Allison Aubrey looks at whether there's any real health benefit for people who don't have celiac disease. And that's the condition where people can't tolerate gluten.
There was a time, not too many years ago, before gluten-free was a $2.6 billion a year business, when wheat-free alternatives sat in a lonely corner of the health food store. Now, when you walk through a market, you can be inundated with options.
Our seafood refresco is gluten-free. Our dips are all gluten-free. We make gluten-free crab cakes.
Chris Hoagie has a booth at the Penn Quarter Fresh Farm Market in D.C. Market director Ann Yonkers says many more vendors are following suit.
We've just had a lot more interest from bakers who are getting more sophisticated in terms of baking things that are gluten-free, that are delicious.
So why are so many people going out of their way to avoid gluten? Well, some of them have celiac disease. Their bodies can't handle gluten, which is a protein found in wheat and other grains. It makes them sick. Now, researchers estimate that fewer than 1% of Americans have this disease. And Fresh Market shopper Elizabeth Malone is not among them. But she's chosen to go gluten-free anyway, and she says she feels better.
I find that I'm a lot healthier because of it. You know, we don't eat any processed food anymore. You can't call Domino's and order a pizza. It's just a much healthier way of being in a lot of ways.
Elizabeth started eating gluten-free because of her husband. She says he's got a wheat intolerance. Now, experts in the medical community used to poo-poo the idea of wheat sensitivities. Some doctors thought if you didn't have celiac disease, any bad reaction to wheat was just in your imagination. But Dan Leffler, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard, says this is changing.
There's been a number of studies over the last couple years, a small number but convincingly done, that show that there really is a phenomenon of what's now known as non-celiac gluten sensitivity. These are people clearly don't have celiac disease, but at the same time do have symptoms when they're exposed to gluten.
Symptoms such as bloating, gas, and other GI problems. Leffler says it's impossible to put a number on exactly how many people have some degree of gluten sensitivity. But he says it's likely that some portion of the millions of people diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome don't tolerate gluten well.
Gluten is a very difficult protein to digest. It doesn't get broken down in the way many other proteins or sugars do.
And for some people, that means the work of breaking it down is pretty much left up to the bacteria in the gut.
And when that happens, the bacteria create gas and acids, and at least a fair proportion of people, it's those byproducts of bacterial digestion of gluten that's causing symptoms.
There are plenty of people out there who tolerate gluten just fine. But a recent survey by the market research firm Packaged Facts finds some of them have other motivations for buying gluten-free foods. Joel Wardy works for a company called Enjoy Life Foods. They make lots of gluten-free sweets. He says people often think they're healthier.
Because it's called gluten-free, people assume gluten must be bad, because why else would you want gluten-free?
And some people think it'll help them shed a few pounds. They figure if they're giving up wheat, then they're giving up carbs. And hey, that's got to be good for the waistline. But here's why this thinking does not work. There are too many delicious gluten-free goodies out there, like this one.
So we're going to let you taste a chocolate chip cookie, and you're going to tell me whether or not you don't think it tastes like the best chocolate chip cookie you've ever had.
It's chocolate, so of course it tastes good. Harvard's Dan Leffler says his research shows that a lot of people actually gain weight on a gluten-free diet. He says, by all means, try a gluten-free diet if you think your body doesn't handle it well. But don't be fooled into thinking that it's somehow healthier for everyone. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
Today is World Food Day. It's an annual event that marks the 1945 launch of the United Nations effort to track global hunger. Progress has been made in fighting hunger over the past decade, but still, nearly a billion people don't have enough to eat, mostly in South Asia and Africa. And some economists say financial speculation in food commodities is part of the reason. Here to discuss the debate is NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn G. Wax. Marilyn, welcome.
Good morning.
So how does trading in commodities, this sort of thing happening off in Wall Street, affect our prices at the grocery store?
Well, at least in theory, commodities markets should help make food cheaper for all of us. And here's how it's supposed to work. Say a company needs corn to make cornflakes. You could go to a commodities exchange and agree to buy the corn at a particular price, and it's all spelled out in a contract. And you can go forward with your plans to make your cornflakes. You took a risk. Maybe if you'd waited a little longer, the prices would have gone down. But really, unbalanced, the deal made sense.
So what's the problem?
The concern now is that there are just too many big investors that are betting on food solely to make a profit. They don't grow corn. They don't make cornflakes. They really never even want to take possession of any of these grains. They're looking for a profit. Now, critics say that these financial investors are the same people that, you know, back in the 1990s drove up tech stocks, and we got a tech bubble out of that. And then 10 years ago, they started in on residential real estate. In both cases, we ended up with a tech bubble, a housing bubble, and it hurt the economy. So critics are saying that these same kinds of investors are now creating commodities bubbles that could burst and hurt us as well.
Now, how much of the increase in food prices is actually tied into this kind of speculation? I mean, I read reports about things like the cost of peanut butter going up. But, you know, there, that deals with crops and the weather. So how do we know it's speculation?
Right. I mean, peanut butter is a good example. That's pretty much just a weather story for the most part. There was a terrible southern drought, and that hurt the peanut crop. Some critics say that there's other things like ethanol policy that encourages farmers to turn too much of their corn into fuel, and that helps drive up food prices. And most of all, there's just this simple law of supply and demand. There are a lot of people in China and other parts of the world. They're making more money now, so they're hungry. They want to buy food. And that means demand has been outstripping the supplies. So we've got a lot of factors that contribute to rising food prices. But this speculation issue, people say that's exacerbating all the underlying issues. There's a UN report that just came out that said that money that was invested in food commodities shot from $13 billion in 2003 up to $260 billion in 2008.
So, Marilyn, is anyone actually trying to curb speculation?
This past week, a group of about 500 economists from 40 different countries signed a letter urging U.S. commodity regulators to try to tamp down on this speculation. And there are new rules that are being considered right now under that Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act. They haven't been finalized yet, but they're working on it. And next month, the leaders of the G20, that's the group of 20 biggest economies, they're going to take up this issue when they meet. But, you know, some people say that markets should be left alone, that speculators' money doesn't really hurt consumers, that in the long run, prices are set by supply and demand. So if farmers plant more corn than people want to eat, the prices are going to go down. And that's really what we've seen in recent trading.
NPR senior business editor Marilyn G. Wax. Marilyn, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
From NPR News, it's Weekends on All Things Considered. Guy Raz is away. I'm Rebecca Roberts.
My children, you know, they're 2 and 4. I mean, they're just normal, active kids. And you know, I'm really active. I, you know, work out every day and run on my lunch break. But we eat McDonald's once a week. I don't think that's going to hurt my kids in particular.
That's 28-year-old mom Christy Coleman. She lives in Stafford, Virginia with her two young boys, both extremely picky eaters. Christy often has to fight with them to eat anything at all. So the fact that they like McDonald's, especially the French fries, is a good thing. It's not their daily fare, just a weekly treat before church on Wednesday nights. On a recent visit, when Christy opened the boys' Happy Meals, something was awry. The small carton of French fries had gotten even smaller. Tiny, in fact.
When they do want to eat, they will eat all of their fries, and I don't think that they should get 15 or 20 less fries because McDonald's thinks that they need to eat apples as well.
Apple slices. That's what McDonald's has added to every Happy Meal. At the same time, the company has decreased the amount of French fries in the kids' meals down to nearly 1 ounce.
And just to be nice, I said, please keep the apples. My boys won't eat them. They're just going to get thrown away. And they said, no, we have to put them in the box. And I was like, really? Because I'm just going to walk over and put them in the trash can. And that's like what really started it. And I was really mad. I was upset. Because they not only make you take apples, but they're taking the food away that my kids actually do eat.
When it announced the new Happy Meal, McDonald's said it aims to help customers, especially children and families, make nutrition-minded choices for their daily lifestyles. But whose choice is it, really? That's our cover story for today. Christy Coleman feels her choice is being taken away.
If a parent really wanted their kids to eat apples, they would say, no, my child cannot have French fries, only let him substitute the apples, or don't let them eat at McDonald's at all, you know, if your kid has an obesity problem.
That obesity problem, of course, is what's behind these and other nutritional changes.
Well, I'm not quite convinced that obesity is a problem it's made out to be.
Julie Guthman is a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and author of the book Weighing In, Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism.
The way many of the statistics are constructed seem to overstate the problem. I'll give you an example. The body mass index that is commonly used to measure obesity and obesity prevalence is essentially a ratio of weight to height. So if somebody has a big bone structure or works out a lot and has a lot of muscle mass, they will have a higher BMI.
For those who truly are overweight, Guthman says, choosing among problematic options isn't the answer.
By the time people walk into that McDonald's restaurant, they've already decided they want a burger. And all power to them if that's what they feel like eating. so many of the problems really stem from the way we produce food, whether it's the agricultural chemicals we use or the hormones we use in producing beef, the antibiotics we use in beef. These warrant public discussion about how we should produce food.
But in the meantime, how much choice should consumers have? Dr. Brian Wansink is the director of the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab, as well as the author of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. He says we're not even aware of most of the choices we're making about food.
Regardless of how tuned in we think we are to the food decisions we make and how much we eat, we're a nation of mindless eaters. In one study we did, we found the typical person makes over 200 decisions about food every day. Because it's not just whether you want sort of a super salad, but it's, you know, how much salad you're going to eat, whether you're going to finish it, what sort of dressing you're going to be putting on, what do you leave. And the thing is, most of these decisions we're not even aware of, which is why the environment around us, the little things on the table or next to us, have a huge impact, typically nudging us in the wrong direction to eat worse or to eat more than we otherwise would.
There are a lot of restaurants who are doing things like including calorie counts on their menus. And, you know, McDonald's has reduced the amount of fries that are in their Happy Meals and are including apple slices in addition to the fries. Do you think those sorts of things will actually change the way we eat?
With a restaurant menu labeling, calorie labeling, we're getting a mixed bag. A lot of those studies have shown that it doesn't seem to have the impact that we kind of want. And in fact, in some studies we've been doing, we find that different people, especially at fast food restaurants, are looking for different things when they go there. If you're going with just a couple bucks in your pocket, you're going to see calories, and you're going to say, oh, great, what's going to make me most full for $2.50? You're not going to say, how can I minimize calories? In that case, something like calorie labeling can actually lead somebody who maybe should be eating fewer calories to actually order the most caloric thing. With McDonald's, it's a great example. We've done a lot of work with kind of the idea of the Happy Meal, observing things that go on in restaurants. And one of the things we found out that goes on in restaurants is that the Happy Meal is over at one specific time, and that time is when the kid opens the toy. And so one of the things we found is that with most Happy Meals, the French fries weren't being eaten by the kid. They were being eaten by the parent who's finishing them up. So the decision to go to smaller French fries, actually around 100 calories worth of French fries, is a really reasonable decision because it's actually going to keep the kids eating healthy, but it's going to help the parents eat a whole lot healthier.
You said that we make 200 decisions about our food, and you know that can be as simple as whether or not to eat, but anyone who's ever stood behind someone at a coffee shop who has been ordering a half-calf, low-foam, skim, two-shot, caramel whip, and it takes them 25 minutes to get the order out, you know, is there now an expectation that we get all these choices when we pay for our food in a restaurant? When McDonald's changes what's in a Happy Meal, does that run the risk of making consumers think, hey, I wanted to make that decision?
When I take my girls to McDonald's, they always get the apples, they get a cheeseburger, and they get the non-fat milk. But it's still a Happy Meal, so they love it. Now, those alternatives have always been available to somebody in recent years who wanted to eat at McDonald's and order a Happy Meal. But what they're doing now is, I think, something that's very intelligent. It's what Burger King and a lot of the other big players are doing too, is they are really in your face saying, look, you can have any choice you want, this or this, you choose, which one? And I think making it really obvious to people that they have the latitude to come up with the different combinations is good, because in the past, you could do that, but mainly only if you knew that you were able to do that. Now they're making that very bold and clear to people.
Brian Wansink is the director of the Cornell University Food and Brand Lab and the author of the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
So given adequate information, can we be trusted to make healthy decisions about what we eat and balance the burgers with broccoli? Marion Nessel is professor of nutrition and food studies at New York University and is the author of three books, including her most recent, What to Eat. She says there should be a common American interest in making sure all of our food options are healthier.
I don't see that as taking the choice away. People still have the choice. Right now, the default is junk food. How about making the default healthy food? People can always order junk food if they want to. Nobody's stopping them from doing that.
Is there a way to make healthy food the default and junk food a treat, or should junk food just not be a choice at all?
Oh, I think junk food has a place in American diets. I have my own favorites, and everybody does. Nobody is talking about trying to get rid of these foods. These foods are not cigarettes. With cigarettes, the issue was very simple. You just want people to stop smoking, and if you had the choice, you would put cigarette companies out of business. With food, it's much more complicated. So what you want is you want healthy foods to be most of what people are eating and junk foods to be occasional treats. Nobody ever thought that fast food would be what people ate every day.
What's your reaction to things like soda taxes or trans fat bans? Can those have an effect on the way people eat?
Of course they can, in the same way that those kinds of approaches helped people stop smoking. People don't really have a lot of control over what they eat. I know that sounds completely ridiculous. But if you give somebody a large portion of food, or if you put food in front of someone, that person is going to eat it. So the idea of trying to get people to stop smoking and change their behavior around diets is to try to make it easier for people to eat more healthfully.
Does consumer education, in your opinion, work? Can people be trusted to make the right decisions if they have the right information?
To some extent, the education helps a lot. But in addition, I think we have to make things easier for people. It's very, very difficult to eat healthfully if you're surrounded by foods that are going to encourage you to eat more of the wrong kinds of things than you particularly want to. So all of those things have to go on at once. But I think by this time, everybody realizes that the food environment is something that has been promoting poor health for a very long time now, and that we not only have to educate people, but we also have to change the environment at the same time. If we as a society want to have healthy people, we're going to have people who eat healthfully. And I think health benefits everybody.
People make choices all the time that are ultimately not particularly great for their health. You know, they ride a motorcycle, they don't wear their seatbelts. Why do you think food has become such an area of attention?
Food is just like everything else. Yes, people will make choices that are bad for their health, and the government has stepped in all of the cases that you mentioned, in order to make it harder for people to make those bad choices. You need to wear a seatbelt, and if you don't, you get into trouble. I don't see why this is any different in that situation. We do things as a society to try to help people make healthier choices, and that works for food as well as for all those other things.
That's NYU Nutrition and Food Studies Professor Marion Nessel, who wrote the book What to Eat. She's been speaking with us from her office in New York. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.